This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your State Society of CPAs for your personal, non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the Weekly Tax Update for April the 1st, 2013. And no, we are not going to try to play any jokes or tricks on you. There's enough of that in the tax developments for the week. In our first electronic communication, an email from the Chief Counsel's office, an IRS employee is advised that a taxpayer who disagrees with an employment tax assessment has only one recourse. That is to pay the employment tax and then file a claim to recover, and when the IRS denies the claim, sue to recover, because the IRS does not issue a notice of deficiency. Without a notice of deficiency, the taxpayer cannot get into tax court. Next, we have a Chief Counsel email explaining that state law determines who has signature authority for a partnership and that the identity of a tax matters partner is irrelevant, because the Tax Matters Partner statute does not give the Tax Matters Partner authority to bind the entity, which I find very interesting. Next, the IRS releases a series of questions and answers for groups that have declared themselves to be tax-exempt. That is, they have not filed an application for pre-approval, but have simply organized and then begun to file Forms 990. 1,300 of those organizations are going to receive invitations to respond to provide the IRS with certain information about their operations. Next, a classic case of reasonable compensation for corporate officers and some employees who were family members involving a successful C corporation down in Arkansas. Next, an attempt to transfer patents to a corporation where the shareholder reported the payments as capital gain, but the corporation deducted the payments as ordinary deductions. You can imagine that didn't work. That's a field attorney advisory. Then another field attorney advisory advising that a cash settlement payment made by a business entity for compensatory damages is an ordinary business expense. I believe that one has going to have to do with the blowout of an oil well. We can take a look at the facts. Karen Hawkins speaks on conflicts of interest, explaining that CPAs do not necessarily have to recuse themselves when there is a conflict, but they must have a clear understanding with the client about the conflict. A update on the status of the Loving litigation, in which several tax return preparers have challenged the IRS's authority to regulate return preparers. And finally, the IRS's 2012 Employee Plans Issue Focus Paper, which reminds us that even if we terminate a qualified plan, the plan must be updated to comply with all rules that are currently in effect, even though the date for compliance may not have passed. If you terminate the plan before compliance, you must make sure the plan is in compliance. You must amend your documents before you actually terminate the plan. With that, let's start with Electronic Communication 2013-12039, in which the IRS states as follows. The IRS does not issue a notice of deficiency for employment tax on amounts employees received that should have been characterized as wages. The taxpayer cannot file a petition in tax court, so the only avenue for resisting the IRS's assessment is to pay the amount of tax that is assessed on a Form 941, file a claim for refund on a Form 941X, wait for the IRS to act. If they don't act within 6 months, then you sue to recover your money in U.S. District Court. The next electronic communication, 2013-12043, is one in which the IRS states that state law determines who has signature authority for a partnership. The identity of the tax matters partner doesn't matter, because the tax matters partner statute, while it gives the tax matters partner the authority to deal with the IRS on behalf of the partnership, does not give the tax matters partner the authority to bind the entity. Therefore, the examining agent in this case is instructed as follows. You will need to look at the operating agreement of the partnership to see who its manager is under state law. That won't necessarily be an owner. Next, a news item that appeared on March 22nd, headed, IRS releases Q&A on questionnaire for some groups that declare themselves to be tax exempt. The IRS has mailed letters to more than 1,300 organizations that have self-declared themselves as tax exempt. under Section 501 C4, C5, or C6, asking those organizations to complete the questionnaire online. Only organizations that receive the letter may complete or are required to complete and submit the questionnaire. Completing the questionnaire is optional, but it is encouraged. Now follow what happens. How much time does an organization have to complete this optional questionnaire? 60 days from the date of the cover letter. If additional time is needed, we will grant up to an additional 30 days to respond. Is the questionnaire part of an exam? No, this questionnaire is part of a voluntary compliance check, not an examination. We are not reviewing your books and records, contacting third parties, or requesting verification of the information you provide. Although your organization may choose not to complete and submit the questionnaire, we may refer your organization for an examination if it does not do so. What kind of voluntary compliance is that? Well, I don't suppose we'll get that question answered today, right? K&K Veterinary Supply, a classic shareholder compensation case in which, in a battle of expert witnesses, the taxpayer's expert opinion fell far short, whereas the government had the right expert. This is the story of executive salaries paid in a very successful family-owned veterinary supply business. They were wholesalers. They sold roughly $19,000 different products. They dealt with somewhere between 550 and 600 vendors. The sole shareholder was J. Lipsmeyer. His brother, D. Lipsmeyer, was vice president, secretary, and assistant chief financial officer. The wives of the two brothers, one who was a shareholder, one who was not, worked in the business, and the daughter of J. Lipsmeyer also worked in the business. She was the chief financial officer. J. Lipsmeyer's duties were those you would expect of a chief executive officer. In addition, he also spent about 7 out of 20 working days per month making sales calls on about 34 of the customers. His brother, D. Lipsmeyer, was responsible for keeping in touch, managing the contacts with about 100 vendors, and also dealing with a number of key customers. J. Lipsmeyer's daughter was the chief financial officer and had been since 2002. She had 90 college credit hours in business finance and had worked part-time for the company beginning in 1988 and then began working full-time and had worked full-time as the chief financial officer for 19 years. So one issue here is reasonable compensation for this family group. A second issue is reasonable rent for property owned by a family partnership and rented to the successful C Corporation. 2 years are involved, 2006 and 2007. In 2006, J. Lipsmeyer's salary was $981,000. In 2007, $746,000. In 2006, D. Lipsmeyer made $923,000. In 2007, $735,000. And each of their wives, M. Lipsmeyer, the wife of J. Lipsmeyer, made $215,000 in 2006, $198,000 in 2007, while Ms. Stewart, the daughter of J. Lipsmeyer, made $287,528 as the chief financial officer in 2006 and $287,429 as chief financial officer in 2007. The rental for business property, warehouse, and office space was $564,000 in 2006 and $651,000 in 2007 after the space had been enlarged. As a result of an audit, the IRS proposed to disallow $363,000 of officer compensation paid to Mr. and Mrs. J. Lipsmeyer, a portion of the deduction claimed for officer's compensation to D. Lipsmeyer, the brother who did not own any stock, and to his wife, and a portion of the deduction claimed for the daughter, M. Lipsmeyer, or M. Stewart. She was married. Taxpayer presented an expert witness, and the government presented an expert witness. The problem was the taxpayer's expert witness didn't do a very good job of preparation. His comparables were off the mark. The taxpayer's expert did not secure the confidence of the judge, while the IRS's expert did. The court applied the classic test, considering employee qualifications, the nature, extent, and scope of employees' work, the size and complexity of the business, the general economic conditions, comparison of salaries paid with gross and net income, the prevailing rates of compensation in that industry, in that area, the salary policy of the taxpayer as to all employees, and the testimony of the government's expert, compensation paid in previous years, comparison of salaries with distribution and retained earnings, and the concept of debt guarantee. Even though this corporation paid a $30,000 a year dividend, the court concluded that the salaries paid to the owner, the owner's wife, the owner's brother's wife, and to the owner's daughter were excessive. Similarly, the taxpayer's expert on the valuation of the property which the corporation rented didn't hold up. The government had the better expert, and so the government carried the day. The salaries paid to the group of family members were reduced significantly. The amount of rent was also reduced significantly, the deduction for rent. Now, the taxpayers then suggested that they should be able to recompute their income. They wanted to take advantage of the equitable recoupment defense to the tax assessment. Since the corporation did not get a deduction for wages and the taxpayers had reported wages, the taxpayers now sought to have the payments treated as a dividend, because that was taxpayers said that these payments had been reclassified as a dividend, therefore they should be taxable as a dividend at a lower tax rate. The court refused to buy that argument, referring to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision in Catalano back in 2001. Here's a quote. We need consider only the second element of the test. That is the second element of the equitable recoupment test. The doctrine of equitable recoupment does not apply because we do not have inconsistent legal theories. It was not inconsistent for the tax court to deny a corporate-level deduction for the lease payments while requiring Catalano to include his receipt of those payments in his individual ordinary income. The corporation and its shareholder are separate entities. The tax outcome results from the structure Catalano chose for this transaction. So, disallowing the deduction for wages did not convert the payments into a dividend, nor did it relieve the taxpayers of the responsibility for paying tax at ordinary income rates. It simply relieved the corporation of a tax deduction. And that's the result you can expect to get if you don't carefully watch reasonable compensation in C-Corps. It isn't, oh well, if they disallow the wages, we'll treat it as a dividend. You can't do that. Next, we have a shareholder attempting to take advantage of whatever he thought was a glitch in the tax law by transferring a patent to his corporation pursuant to a contract which provided for a set payment every month for a set number of months. Treating that as a sale of the patent to the corporation and treating the payments that he received as capital gain, while the corporation did not capitalize the patent on its books and treated each of the payments as an ordinary deduction. As you can see, there's some disintermediation in that. When the IRS caught up with them, the field attorney advisory states very simply that the patents were sold by the shareholder, that no corporate deductions were triggered by the installment payments made to the shareholder, and the IRS was entitled to rely on the documents that constituted a contract between the parties, which is said were explicit and controlling, and in fact, the document transferred all rights to the patent to the corporation. And so, while it was reasonably treated as capital gain by the shareholder, the payments were not deductible by the corporation, but rather the amount paid, the amount that was figured to have been paid for the patent was going to be amortized over a period of years, longer, by the way, than the period that the payments were made. That's Field Attorney Advisory 2013-1201F. Then, in Field Attorney Advisory 2013-0501F, we have what I think is a blown-out oil well. Taxpayer made cash payments to settle potential liability for environmental contamination, and the IRS says that's an ordinary and necessary business expense, in part because the payment was compensatory, not prohibited under the public policy doctrine of Section 162, and was not a fine or a penalty. In fact, the taxpayer had received invoices from the people to whom it made these compensatory payments, and the IRS in its ruling in this field attorney advisory points out, in contrast to non-deductible fines and penalties, compensatory damages that are intended to return the parties to the status quo do not constitute fines or penalties, and they cite for that principle True, T-R-U-E versus United States, a decision of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in 1990, as well as Treasury Regulation 1.162-21B2. During an American Law Institute continuing legal education webcast on the subject of conflict of interest in Circular 230, Karen Hawkins explained that practitioners should take a two-step approach to complying with Section 10.29 of Circular 230. First, defining the potential conflict of interest, and then determining whether representation might still be possible. Once a conflict has been identified, the tax professional must have a conversation with the taxpayer about whether representation is possible. Ms. Hawkins pointed out that proposed changes to Section 10.35, 10.36, and 10.37 will do a better job of clarifying the tax representative, the federally authorized tax practitioner's responsibilities for maintaining professional competence. And one area of professional competence would, of course, be identifying conflicts of interest. The conflict of interest rule interacts, of course, with the due diligence rule. By way of update, on March the 27th, the Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia denied the IRS's motion to lift a district court's injunction barring the IRS from enforcing regulations that govern the tax return preparer registration program. The IRS continues to believe it will prevail and is actively pursuing its appeal, but oral arguments on that appeal are not likely to be heard until sometime in the fall. And so those practitioners who are not CPAs, enrolled agents, or attorneys continue to exist in some sort of a limbo as to whether they are required to complete the professional education and required to complete the testing. As of now, they are not. They may well be so required before the year is over. Finally, this week, the IRS has released its 2012 Employee Plans Issue Focus Paper. Here's the deal. A terminating qualified plan, must be amended for all current law which is applicable to the plan, even if the date by which the plan is required to be amended has not yet passed. And so we have amendments that are required by the Pension Protection Act of 2006, the HEROES Earning Assistance and Relief Act of 2008, the Worker Retiree and Employee Recovery Act of 2008, the Small Business Jobs Act of 2010, the Preservation of Access to Care for Medicare Beneficiaries and Pension Relief Act of 2010. All of those have provisions in them that relate to qualified plans, and the final date for making amendments to the plan, conforming amendments, has not yet passed. But if you want to terminate a plan, you've got to amend the plan first, which seems a little odd, but that's the rule. That's the 2012 Employee Plans Issue Focus. Anyone who's thinking about terminating a qualified plan certainly would need to make sure that you update the plan for all the rules before you try to terminate it. Well, that's a wrap for this week, and I did get through the program with no April Fool's jokes, so at least one thing will not be held up for levity this week. I appreciate you joining me each week. Until we're together next week, stay safe.